News in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Peace. This is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM.
My name is Nida, and I'm a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement. The PYM is proud to be joining hundreds of organizations from around the world in participating in the March to Gaza, taking place in Egypt, June 12th through the 20th. Thousands of people from around the world will gather together to march through Al-Arish and reach the Rafah border with Gaza to demand an immediate end to the genocide on our people and the immediate administration of aid that the people of Gaza are in desperate need of right now. The situation in Gaza has been catastrophic, and it has been catastrophic for 18 months. The time to act is now. We call on the masses of the world to join us in action. We'll see you in Egypt.
Giù nel Medio Oriente come un bufalo ferito, in furia il pirata americano.
Ma nei campi sulle dune sono armati anche i bambini, ogni donna ha in pugno il suo fucile.
No, non fan paura i carri armati di Israele, la tua terra tu la devi liberare.
Abbiamo alzato rosso, il verde, il bianco e il nero, stretta il pugno la bandiera, i colori.
Chiamano banditi i giornali dei padroni, che chiamavano assassini partigiani.
Noi non crederemo ai bollettini israeliani, al tiranno Giordano traditore.
Quante volte ci hanno detto è finita in Palestina, e ancora cantavamo la canzone.
Abbiamo alzato rosso, il verde, il bianco e il nero, stretta in pugno la bandiera, i colori di Al-Fatah.
Abbiamo alzato la bandiera partigiana della rossa Palestina, accanto a quella del Vietnam.
Al di là di questo mare c'è un popolo fratello, ogni lotta aiuta un'altra lotta.
Ogni colpo sparato sul nemico sionista, Italia colpisce chi comanda.
Coi popoli in rivolta si muove oggi la storia.
Rivoluzione, viva la vittoria!
Abbiamo alzato rosso, il verde, il bianco e il nero, stretta in pugno la bandiera, i colori di Al-Fatah.
Abbiamo alzato la bandiera partigiana della rossa Palestina accanto a quella del Vietnam.
That was Rosa Palestina, a revolutionary song that is traditional on the Italian left, I should say. And it's on the occasion of the fact that the Puglenia region, which includes Bari on the east coast of Italy, has just cut off relationships with Israel. Parts, even though Italy is a fascist country, it has there's regions of it that and cities like Naples that have been incredible in their solidarity with Palestine. And before that, we heard that appeal to march on Gaza, and this is the global march on Gaza. Thousands of people in hundreds of buses and cars are traveling to the Rafah border that lies between Egypt and Palestine to try to enter Gaza. Of course, they are going to be intercepted by all kinds of reactionary forces. But I should also point out that not only are there Arab activists traveling across from Tunisia, going through Libya, going through Morocco, going through Egypt, and then entering the Rafah border, or trying to enter the Rafah border. But there are European activists that are traveling from all over Europe by air and landing in Cairo to try to join that group and march on Gaza. This is to bring attention, of course, to the starvation of Gazans. And this has also been triggered by the Gaza flotilla, which has been intercepted before it reached Gaza, carrying food and aid. And on that, that is a nice transition to our conversation today. Our short conversation, we'll have Ian for about 20 minutes today. Ian Urbina is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. I had the pleasure of working with him on one of the best exposés on Libya. It was titled, if you want to look it up, The Secretive Prisons That Keep Migrants Out of Europe. And I played Rosa Palestina intentionally today because Italy was one of the main culprits in intercepting these migrants that were going from the African continent and trying to reach other places of refuge. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks for having me, Zain.
Ian, can you talk about, can you inform the audience? We had interviewed you before in the wake of the amazing expose, which you risked your life to get through and was harmed by it, actually. If you can talk about your organization and what it does.
Sure. Yeah. So I spent 17 years at the New York Times. And when I left there, I created a nonprofit news organization. It's called the Outlaw Ocean Project. And we focus on investigative narrative stories about the watery two-thirds of the planet, quite especially looking at sort of the intersection of environmental and human rights abuses that are happening at sea, predominantly on distant fishing water vessels. We also, though, look at other urgent matters that are playing out on the water and try to take an informed look at you know, sort of how the fact that it's happening in this liminal space, i.e. at sea, is relevant, and also just sort of trying to shed light on a portion of the planet that rarely gets journalistic coverage.
Right. And recently we've been getting a lot of coverage on that part of the world, of course, as you know, with the Gaza flotilla reports on the Gaza flotilla. Also, Libya, the topic that you addressed in your expose in the New Yorker, that Libya has been back sort of on the news a little bit, not as much as it should be, but for one, because among the other harebrained ideas that Trump presented for the displacement of Palestinians is to displace them into Libya. Which you proved with your article is one of the most dangerous places for refugees. And secondly, because recently the actual, I don't know if you heard, but the flotilla that was going to Gaza came across refugees who were at sea and who were about to be intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard before the refugees actually warned, told the people aboard the flotilla for Gaza that these people have bad intentions, meaning the Libyan Coast Guard. So they took four of them on board of the Gazan flotilla. And also Libya's back, to be mentioned, is because of this global march on Gaza. Will be going through a big stretch of Libya, which will be interesting how it will be received or intercepted. But it's back and on the news. Yeah. Today I wanted to give you the opportunity and to talk about your upcoming projects that you've started now, another phase of your work.
Yeah, no, I mean, thank you for that. And I would just build on your point. I think if you look at what's happening on the Mediterranean and you look at the way the EU generally and Italy in specific have essentially erected an invisible wall across the Mediterranean, and they've outsourced migration control to a failed state, namely the militias of Libya, you see a larger phenomena. You know, you see the southernization of borders, which is to say, typically in the form of global north wealthier countries that are eager to stop poor, desperate people seeking refuge from reaching their shores. So they outsource and fund and even orchestrate and arm other nations that are southern of them, that are further out from their border, to block those people first. And this didn't start with Italy and Libya. You know, the US government was doing this long before Trump, and was funding prisons and detention centers in Mexico to try to stop migrants from reaching US soil, while they'll have where they would have the benefit of journalists and US protections and the like. And Australia is doing it as well in Papua New Guinea. And so this is a phenomenon that I think we're going to see more of, especially as climate migration accentuates desperation. More and more people are going to be trying to leave where they are and find hope elsewhere. And wealthier nations and governments are probably going to resort to these sorts of tactics so as to get around, you know, sort of more progressive liberal democracy laws and civil society roles. So I think it's a very worrisome. Obviously, the Trump administration, what's happening now is this whole phenomenon on steroids. And so the notion of shipping migrants from the US to, you know, the prison in El Salvador or Gitmo or Libya is part of the same overall notion. Let's get them out of here. But I think it's wise for us to be thinking about it in a global sense and calling it, you know, when it's happening in multiple places, which it is.
Yes, for sure. And climate change is a big factor in this, and your work is going to become increasingly more important and critical as climate change escalates, and as you mentioned, as migration increases, in light of, you know, it seems to me that from talking to certain people that have the inside story on how the U.S. government intends or has been intending to deal with climate change, is of course with the Pentagon developing a sort of gunboat policy rather than something to deal with climate change, rather to deal with the outcome of climate change and keep our energy policy as is. And so we're going to have mass migrations across the oceans, and the work of the Outlaw Ocean Project is going to become even more important. Having said that, what are you looking at these days? What's your project focusing on?
Yeah, I mean, you were kind enough to have me on now, partially because last week we launched season two of the Outlaw Ocean podcast. It consists of 8 episodes. 3 of them are about what we call the China, the superpower of seafood. And it's a sort of in-depth look at human rights and environmental crimes on what is the world's largest fishing fleet, but also the use of state-sponsored forced labor in the form of North Koreans and Uyghurs from Xinjiang in China's on-land seafood processing infrastructure. Much of that seafood ends up on U.S., Canadian, European plates, so everyone is complicit. So that's a three parts of the series. And then another three parts are taking a revisit to the Libyan reporting we did with your help. Then we also have a story about a strange and fascinating, but somewhat sort of illustrative niche industry of maritime repo men. These are guys mostly who work on behalf of mortgage lenders and banks and essentially steal ships on behalf of their disgruntled owners or lenders. Typically the stealing, and I put that in air quotes, is sort of taking unilaterally taking a ship from one country's port surreptitiously in violation of local law out to the high seas to bring it to another port where the laws are maybe more in favor of the boat owner. It's a very strange and interesting industry, and we take a look at, and I went on several repos in Haiti and Greece with this guy, and it just makes for fascinating storytelling. And the last piece in the podcast series is a deep look at human rights abuses within the Indian shrimp industry. You know, 2014, 2015, the world became pretty acutely aware through a lot of great journalism of human rights abuses in Thailand in their seafood industry, largely shrimp. A lot of the Western brands moved out of Thailand because they didn't like the bad press, and they shifted to India. Now a third of all shrimp consumed by Americans comes from India. Lo and behold, many of the same abuses exist there: trafficked labor, captive labor, debt bondage, abhorrent, you know, working conditions, use of illegal antibiotics, food safety concerns, and on and on. And so we take a really deep look. We had an amazing whistleblower at an American company based in India who gave us about 50,000 pages of documents that really blew the lid off of that story.
That's incredible. When you say that you went on several repo trips, you were physically there, Ian? Like when you do these book, podcast episodes are about actual documentation of these actual journeys on the sea, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I left the Times and created this odd, you know, niche little organization is I wanted to do the journalism in a certain way and differently, even if it was more expensive and slow, which it is. But we only take on stories where we can report in theater, if you will. So we're not going to tell the Libya story unless I can get on the ground in Libya. We just feel like if we're going to spend that much time taking on a really tough topic, we should really be there. So yes, the repos were repos that I joined this guy on as he conducted them.
That's fascinating. A friend of mine, Leila Khalili, I don't know if you ever read her work on Sinews of Trade and War. Great book. Did you ever come across that one, Ian?
I did. Yeah, I did. It's a fantastic book, and I know of Leila. I have not met her.
Yeah, I we've interviewed her on this show, and she's actually a friend of the family. Fascinating stuff on riding and on the when she actually goes on the ship and documents all this stuff. It is also for her one of the inspirations is Cities of Salt, which is a trilogy about the history of Saudi Arabia but under the name of a fictional country. I wanted to also ask you about the other episodes on the, when people want to go to this, first of all, they just can go to the podcast, Outlaw Ocean podcast.
That's right. Yeah. On any platform. If you search for that, you'll find it. It's also on our website, theoutlawocean.com.
Excellent. And for the other part where you revisited Libya, with the couple of episodes, what did you find in that revisit?
Yeah, I mean, it's To a large degree, it's a recounting of what we reported in writing, but it's an audio version. So, but the revelations, you know, were number one, you know, despite the rhetoric of the Europeans and the Libyans that this entire campaign of theirs of capturing, you know, tens of thousands of migrants on the water every year, despite their rhetoric that this is a humanitarian effort, it's very clear that it's anything but. They're not there to rescue them from traffickers or to prevent them from drowning. They're there to, because if they were doing that, they would be taking them to a place of safety, not back to Libya, where they put them in some of the most brutal detention settings known on planet Earth, you know, where rape and extortion and murder are common. And furthermore, in case after case that we documented, the Libyans were opening fire on the migrants to force them to stop on the high seas, I would add, which is illegal because Libyans don't have jurisdiction on the high seas, but yet no one's out there to stop them. So that's what happens. So that was one large finding. The other finding was, you know, the Europeans often say, look, we just try to help prevent migrants from drowning, and we're working with the Libyan so-called Coast Guard for that purpose, but we don't fund the detention centers or have any control of the incarceration and abuse on land. That's the militias of Libya, and that's for you to take up with them. Well, that's patently false. You know, we finally found all the documents we needed to show the Europeans and Italians were paying for the vehicles, for the iPads that are counting and naming all the migrants as they're captured. They call in the coordinates, they fly drones. The Europeans are flying drones and propeller planes 24/7 over the Mediterranean. And when they spot the boats, they call it into the Libyan Coast Guard so they can go grab them. The vehicles, the arms. So they are, the Europeans are paying, you know, for everything, though they denied it for years. So these are largely the sort of big findings in that investigation.
Excellent. And in terms of now that China, because of the tariffs and how is the tariff story affecting in relationship to your work and to, especially to these episodes about China that you have in your podcast?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, right? I mean, the administration that's in power now is they are China hawks and are eager to find any opportunity to confront and push back China. So that means that our reporting on China ideologically is something they like. They won't touch our Libya reporting, they won't touch our India reporting, but the China reporting fits within their agenda, which is to say, you know, we've gotten a huge upsurge from, you know, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, U.S. State Department, all these folks that are looking for some way to confront, to sort of do something about the evidence we put forward of state-sponsored forced labor on the ships and on, in plants. Typically, that is in the form of how do we untether ourselves as the American economy from this kind of tainted good, because we don't want taxpayer or non-taxpayer funds going towards this, because we're in a trade war with China, and then partially we care about human rights, but normally that's not a high priority for them. And so that's normally what the calls are. We get, you know, an outreach once a week asking for guidance and input on these things. I don't love the, and don't agree with the ideological motivations, you know, that are part of a larger sort of xenophobic kind of agenda. But I am, you know, happy that there is a desire to look at least this portion of, you know, forced labor tainting goods coming into the U.S. and trying to find a way to better police against that.
Thank you so much, Ian. I know you have to go to your next interview or appointment. Thank you for taking this time to report. And I just wanted to encourage everybody to go to the Outlaw Ocean podcast and check out these exciting new 8 episodes for this season that deal with Libya, China, India, and the Maritime Ripplemen story. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you so much, Zane. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So that was Ian Urbina, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who did an incredible expose on how the Europeans, and specifically countries like Italy, were basically paying the Libyans basically Libyan militias. These are whatever, they're reinvented themselves. These are really not the type of company you would like to keep. Let's put it this way. Basically, for those of you who don't know, and most of you know that the NATO intervention into Libya and Hillary Clinton's bragging about "we came, we saw, we you know, we came, we conquered." He died, talking about the killing of Gaddafi, which was spun as if it's a movement to dictatorship, but it was actually a movement that resulted in Libya being divided into three different countries, basically, three different divisions. At one point, one of these entities, one of these three entities, was actually controlled by ISIS. I don't know to what extent right now. And also, there was a huge reaction, a xenophobic reaction, and especially towards their fellow Africans, you know, because as you know, Libya is in North Africa, but this is, I'm talking about in the African continent in general. And the reason for that is because of Gaddafi was in alliance with several African leaders. And therefore, the reaction wasn't just to kill Gaddafi, but also to attack citizens from the African continent, especially African consulates and embassies that were in Tripoli, where the diplomats were kicked out and had to walk a gauntlet of racist slurs being thrown at them by these new quote unquote revolutionary group that was basically supported by NATO and the United States. And of course, you know, you for a while you heard about Libya for a while, and only in the sense that where both our capitalist imperialist parties were fighting with each other on the incompetency that happened with Libya, and not because of the human rights abuses that increased in its wake, and the decline of the economy, which increased in the wake of the intervention, but simply because they were trying to use it during the election. For example, the emails that were sent by Hillary Clinton that were not secured, so to speak, and so on and so forth. So they left Libya in shambles, and that's why it was prime time for European Union and countries like Italy to pay these militias, who are now, you know, the security forces and the coast guard of the Libyan coast guard, basically, to intercept the these refugees that were traveling from different places in the African continent, of course, Sudan isn't with the African continent, but like Sudanese and others, that were coming, taking to the sea to try to reach the European shores or any kind of refuge. And that's where they were being intercepted by the Libyan, quote, Libyan Coast Guard, which is essentially was a mercenary militia for the Europeans they were being intercepted at sea and taken to this prison. And this is the secretive prisons that Ian Urbina, who we just spoke to, exposed in his article at great cost. And I mean, great cost in the sense that, you know, once they found the Libyan authorities found that he's doing this article, they basically attacked him, beat him, and imprisoned him for a short period before he was released. It was, you know, it was pretty physically damaging for him. You know, he risked his life to get this story out. But among the things that I was, you know, translating for this article that ended up in a New Yorker, translating for Arab speaking Africans such as Sudanese that were in the prison and were able to tell us more about the secretive prisons, and also the fact that that there were people being killed in the prison, and it was unknown to what's happening to them because it wasn't being reported upon, and also that there were the prison guards were extorting the prisoners, extorting money from the prisoners in exchange for access to cell phones where they can call their family and ask them to wire $500, for example, to one of the guards. And at one point, we had this moment where Ian and his crew called me, and I was talking with the guards of this prison in Arabic, obviously, these Libyan guards, and distracting them while the journalists went and flew a drone over the prison and took pictures of what is happening. And it ended up that there's also they're burying people in the back of this prison, the people that they were killing. And so that was a huge expose. I would, you know, you could find the article online, the secretive prisons that keep migrants out of Europe, basically. The other news that I wanted to share with you today, there's a lot of news to share, obviously. And among these, of course, the first major story is many of us were watching what's going to happen with the flotilla to Gaza that was carrying 12 activists along with such stars as Greta Thunberg. That were, of course, traveling to Gaza to break the siege. Of course, they were ready for all scenarios and expected, you know, were anticipating the high probability of them being stopped and arrested. But the point was to make a statement that since the governments of the world, I mean, who would have thought in the 21st century that there's this lack of humanity, that we are witnessing another Holocaust of another people, and we're witnessing millions of good Germans, quote unquote, good Germans that are being quiet, even though the German population, there are many actually Jewish Germans that are involved in protesting for Palestine and are being arrested and accused of, drum roll, anti-Semitism when it's just about protesting against the genocide and the starvation of people and the shredding of children, of Palestinian children. Obviously, the flotilla was intercepted, that there were the people on board were abducted after they had sprayed this white substance on the boat, an unknown substance, and then they were the people were arrested, the activists, and brought on shore. Some of them had to sign deportation papers, but some, like Rima Hassan, who is an MP, a French Palestinian MP, who refused to sign her deportation papers and is still in is in prison right now, being threatened with physical violence if she doesn't sign the papers. And basically, an Al Jazeera journalist who was arrested with her and has been released since while she was kept in prison, was able to report on what was happening. And one of the things he reported on was the fact that that Rima was threatened by one IDF soldier that he's going to bash her head into the wall if she doesn't sign these deportation papers. The irony of this and the poetry, I guess, in this is that Rima Hassan, a Palestinian who's never seen her homeland because it's been occupied and she's been kept out of it, saw it for the first time and smelled the air of Palestine for the first time when she was brought on by the occupational forces, the IDF, basically, onto her land, and was able to see it for the first time in her life, which was a moving thing to think about, a moving moment, I'm sure, for Rima. And Rima was actually quoting the Algerian resistors that fought the French colonialists for a long time. She was quoting one of them who had, upon arrest, was smiling, and she said, "When they arrest me, I'll be smiling like him." And she condemned the Arab leaders, there isn't a single Arab leader, for those of you who don't know. All the Arab leaders, all the Arab governments are with Israel, are with the United States imperial project, are cowards. They haven't lifted a finger. The King of Jordan, who's the biggest traitor, who's all the kings of and emirs of the Gulf countries, all of them are traitors. Sisi of Egypt, who hates Palestinians, really. I just heard an Egyptian journalist talks about he actually hates Palestine. He doesn't just support the occupation. He doesn't just block aid from the Palestinians. He actually hates them, and as did Mubarak, who was deposed basically before him. And part of the reason why these Arab dictators hate the Palestinians is because they inspire revolt in their own countries. For example, many of you might not know that Mubarak, who was overthrown by the Arab Spring, and the Arab Spring, by the way, according to U.S. media, was inspired by Facebook and the same tech that's censoring us now. No, it wasn't inspired. It was inspired by something that the Western media will never mention. It was inspired by the Second Intifada by the Palestinians. And that's the truth. And that's what Mubarak started seeing, these tremors under him. When the Egyptians were rising up, seeing what's happening with the Palestinians resisting one of the most brutal and immoral militaries in the world, they had to confront their own immoral and brutal military, which is, by the way, funded. Egypt is the Egyptian government is second only to Israel in terms of military aid from the United States. So we love to talk about democracy, but every single dictator and king in the United States, in the Arab world, is supported by the United States. They are actually the opposite. They are supporting the destruction of democracy, and they're making sure that democracy does not happen in the United States. And we see it in the wake of every intervention. We also, just another piece of news in terms of what's happening with this, what happened with the flotilla, is that the Spanish activist that was basically reporting from the flotilla also has refused to sign deportation papers and is being kept in prison. So he has just started a hunger strike and also a water strike in prison. And this is a person who we saw images right before he left saying goodbye to his child and to his wife or partner before. It was a very touching moment. He has gone on a hunger strike. So the point for me in my view on this, and this is a view I shared with friends, is that what the whole point of the flotilla, you know, people kept on saying, but they're going to intercept them, but they're going to intercept them. And I said, well, most likely they're going to intercept them. But it's not about whether they're going to be intercepted or not. It's about triggering a global march on Gaza, which has already started, right? It has already started, as I mentioned earlier. It was, the call came out in Tunisia, which was the birthplace of the Arab Spring, if you remember. God bless the Tunisians. And there are doctors, activists, all kinds of peaceful protesters that have loaded up in the thousands, on buses, in their cars, which are painted adorned in the with the Palestinian colors, and are headed across North Africa, going across Algeria, Libya, Morocco, and across Egypt to get to the Rafah border on the far eastern end of the African, on the top of the African continent, to the Rafah border to try to cross. Of course, it's the idea of the flotilla was to inspire dozens and hundreds several Gazan activists online mentioned that they are expecting that this will trigger dozens of flotillas, will trigger dozens of caravans from around the world, which is now happening. As I mentioned earlier, they're coming by land and they're flying off by sea. In Scandinavian countries, I've watched images of people with kufiyas, with Palestinian flags, getting on planes to fly into Cairo to support this. So watch out in the coming days to see what's going to happen. I believe that there will be, you know, within this week, by the end of this week, they will be there at the border. So watch their journey in this global march to Gaza, which is inspiring, and what's necessary in the vacuum of the lack of reaction, the lack of humanity in our governments, while citizens across the world have risen. So that's basically what's happening, the news that I wanted to share with you. And so now in light of talking so much about the African continent, I wanted to play some music again from one of my favorite Sudanese bands, which is actually now based in New York, Al Sahra and the Nubatones. let's start with Al-Watan, the nation.
وحيدة ما يدرى بها الزمن الشجر جف لما تهلك الجزع تشقق وتكسر وين يا وطن وين يا زمن طبا من سنين تتمطى وتفلك في جبينك بالألم وين يا وطن وين يا زمن طبا من سنين وتفلك في جبينك بالألم دمك يسيح أنهار ملح وأنا جنبك بوت عطش حاولت أشرب لما انفجعت أبكي المرارة لما بتتبلع وين يا وطن وين يا زمن قضن من سنين تتمطى وتفلك لك زي العشرة والشجر قلب جذب ماشين سوا نفتش مطر وين يا وطن وين يا زمن قضن من سنين تتمطى وتفلك في جبينك بالألم وين يا وطن وين يا زمن قضن من سنين تتمطى
So that was Al-Sahra and the Nubatones on Watan, and well, this will be followed by their song Al-Furagh.
Thank you.
That was Al-Sahra and the Nubatones with Al-Furag. In terms of just one piece of news before I sign off, in terms of course, the connection that's happening right now between the demonstrations and the protests in LA and also the Palestinian cause, obviously there's, because they're messing with all these groups, the groups are finding more unified action or more a unified ideology that is confronting them. But we're seeing a lot of the what we saw during Black Lives Matter, which was a lot of exchange of information between Palestinian activists and pro-Palestinian activists in general who've been fighting the good fight here in the United States on campuses and outside for the last 19 months, sharing what they know and in terms of self-defense and as they're being attacked by ICE, the LAPD, and of course now with the National Guard and the Marines, and especially now in DC, we're about to be subjected to this big boy birthday event this weekend for Trump, where he's going to do a big military parade, basically showing the equipment that he's going to use against his own citizens, and showing that he is a king with a nation, an imperialist nation, which was actually founded on the rejection of a king, basically. So there are demonstrations everywhere. LA has inspired us everywhere. And I just want to remind you all that the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, was trained in a deadly exchange with what Californians and others call deadly exchange, just like the police here in DC. They were trained in this deadly exchange with the IDF. Basically, policemen, all black, brown, and white, of all colors, were trained to be blue, basically by the IDF. They were basically, why we call it the deadly exchange is because they were essentially going to Israel, they were being sent to Israel, our cops, to be trained to show them how they repress the Palestinians so they can apply it to their own communities of color here in the United States. So people are pointing that out more and more. And the unity that's happening between this growing pro-Palestinian movement across the United States is merging with the growing pro-immigrant and pro-refugee movement across the United States. This is something dynamic and something that I hope will be a powerful confrontation to the fascism that's growing in our country. And with that, we'll end the show. This is Zain Al-Amin signing off. We'll see you next time on the Shai Onana show at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, next Wednesday.
The previous program was a rebroadcast. Stay tuned now for Sophie's Parlor, but first the news.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, June 25th. Here are some headlines. A ceasefire between Iran and Israel appears to be holding today. Speaking at a NATO summit, President Trump said that the United States and Iran would hold talks next week. It was unclear what format the discussions would take or if they would lead to limits on Iran's nuclear program. Meanwhile, Trump continues to hail the American strikes on Iran as a success. The president said late Saturday and again today that Iran's key nuclear sites were completely and fully obliterated. Yet, there is significant skepticism about whether he actually achieved that objective. Speaking yesterday to reporters, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said, quote, "There's zero evidence that I've seen that the nuclear program was completely and totally obliterated, as Donald Trump has claimed. No evidence that has been presented to Congress to suggest that has occurred," close quote. And an early U.S. intelligence assessment that was described to CNN by sources briefed on it said the U.S. strikes on three of Iran's nuclear facilities did not destroy the core components of its nuclear program and likely only set it back by months. CNN reports the assessment was produced by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency and is based on a battle damage assessment conducted by the U.S. Central Command after the U.S. strikes. In other news, dozens continue to die each day as violence in IDF-occupied Gaza continues. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Gaza's Civil Defense Agency said Israeli forces killed another 46 people waiting in line for aid in the Palestinian territory yesterday. 21 people were killed and around 150 wounded by Israeli fire near an aid point in central Gaza, and another 25 were killed in a separate incident in south Gaza. The deaths are the latest in a wave of violence near aid distribution points established by the controversial Israel and U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. UN agencies have condemned the food distribution system, with one official calling it, quote, a death trap, end quote. The Guardian said yesterday that the latest attack brings the total death toll from such attacks in the past 2 weeks to over 500 people. Critics of Netanyahu have accused him of planning the wide-scale eviction of Palestinians by forcing them into inhuman conditions. The aid flowing into Gaza has been insufficient for months, and the IDF continues to cordon off Palestinians into smaller and smaller pockets of territory. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, Zohran Mamdani, a 33-year-old state assembly member and Democratic Socialist, is on the verge of a major upset in the race to be New York City's next mayor. Mamdani declared victory in the Democratic primary last night, defeating his main rival, Andrew Cuomo, who conceded the race. The final tally will not be known until next week, due to New York's ranked choice system that allows citizens to choose up to five candidates in order of preference. Mamdani's campaign focused on affordability, an issue he raised again in a victory speech last night.
We have won because New Yorkers have stood up for a city they can afford. A city where they can do more than just struggle. One where those who toil in the night can enjoy the fruits of their labor in the day.
Mamdani's primary win over a better-known and better-funded contender signified a major victory for liberal activists. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Good.